session number 9253, reel 27.
Mr. Jack Dorgan, reel 27. You were telling me about your activities at Sandham Hall Convalescent Camp.
That's right. Well, I finished that fire screen, and it was mine. And I brought it home. I kept it with me all the time I was in the army, in the hospitals and so on, and brought it home. But I lost it when we lived in London after the war, when I was bombed. I was in a bombed area, our house was bombed, and we lost a lot of stuff. It was only years after that we remembered that certain things had disappeared. However, going back to Sandham Hall, these women organizations, when we were able, not when I was with, first of all, I was on. I had two crutches under my arms. Then I had one. Then I had two sticks. And then when I came to the stage, when I only used one stick for to help me along to walk, they used to come along, and we used to go out to tea. These women organizations used to take a half a dozen of us, a wounded soldiers, convalescent, and give us tea in their church halls or assembly rooms. And they certainly did their best to make our stay with them in Staffordshire as enjoyable as best they could. I'll always have great thanks for the times I spent there. And that was, spent many, many, many months. I was wounded the end of March or the beginning of April, I don't know what date, and I was in Staffordshire the rest of that year, 1916, in Staffordshire, hospitals and then convalescent.
Did you get any visitors from home? Any?
No, never had any visitors from home.
What did you feel about the fact that you were... Were you pleased to be away from the Western Front? Or were you looking forward to getting back? What did you feel about that question?
I don't think I was given a thought. I mean, got to remember, I had two wounds in my leg, and that concerned me much, plenty. And then getting onto my feet and making progress in walking, you know, all that sort of occupied your mind if you ever stopped to think it. You were glad that you were out of the war, naturally.
Did you get any news from the battalion or from your particular friends?
No, not from the battalion, no. But I was in very close touch with my people at home because in the whole of the time... For my being called up in 1914, I made out of my soldier's salary or wage or what you call it, I made an allotment to my mother. And my mother took that allotment, only a few shillings, and she went along to in Ashenden, or hometown, went to the local house agent, and she bought a house. Because she knew that after the war, that I would be getting married. My girlfriend, who had been my girlfriend for several years before the war, and during the whole of the war, we intended to get married after the war. And my mother, in her foresight, she bought a house in Rosalind Street, Ashington, so that when the end of the war, when I was discharged, I had a house. One of my friends who had never been called up, because remember, anyone who worked in a coal mine was in a reserved occupation. And one of my friends, he lived in that house, and I had to wait until he got different accommodation before I could move into my own house.
So you were writing to your mother and vice
versa?
Oh,
yes, my mother's always been close to me. My mother had three sons, myself, or Tom, and Nickel. I believe I've described them before. But I was always her favourite son, and the fact that she did that for me and not for the others showed that, didn't it? Of course, as time went on, you see, in the war, I had a sergeant's pay, so it wasn't so bad. I forget when she started to use my allotment. She never used my allotment except for the buying of that house.
What happened when you came to the end of your convalescence?
Well, I finished in Staffordshire, and then it was for me to go back home. Still convalescent. I was still convalescent when I went back home, and I had my uniform, discarded my blue, hospital blue, and went home, and I was placed on what was called Class W. Now, Class W was devised by those in authority for fellas like me who had been wounded and were fit and well and who worked in the coal mines to be sent home, put in this Class W, this classification, Class W, to work in the coal mine. Because they still needed coal, they needed miners, and miners, of course, some of them were joining up and leaving their reserved occupation, so they had to be replaced to maintain the country's coal supplies. And I was in this Class W, but was liable for be called up on active service at any time.
Who assigned you to Class W? Did you have to go before a medical board?
I was just notified that. I was never given the choice as to go into Class W. Never heard of Class W until I was told I was in Class W. And I could stay at home and work in the pits. So, when I first went home, I was still carrying a stick. I needed a walking stick to help me along. But after a few months at home, my leg improved and I started work underground again as a coal miner. As a coal miner,
When was that?
That was 1917.
About what month?
Oh, the beginning of the months. Early 1917.
January or February?
Yes, I suppose so. I have no recollection. But 1917, for the whole of 1917, I was at home, and I was on Class W, liable for active service at any time, and for the whole of that year, my girlfriend and I, she had been my girlfriend for years, and we had decided to be married at the end of the war. We still held back because I was liable for active service.
Did you go back to Ashington Colliery when you started work down the mines again?
Oh, yes. You see, I went home, which was Ashington, and my father worked at Ashington Colliery as a stone man, and I myself, when I was called up in 1914, had been working down the pit in Ashington Colliery. Ashton & Colliery was very up-to-date collieries, as collieries went in those days. And I started work on the same job that I had left in 1914, but it was a matter of several years since. However...
So you were working as a putter still?
Yes, that was when I went back on Class W. Is that what you're meaning?
Yes.
Yes, on Class W, I went back to the same job that I had been doing when war was declared, putting. But this time, being 21 years of age, I had additional money. I had fourpence a score more than the usual rate of pay. And also, being 21, I got a shilling extra for every score of tubs I brought out. Put in.
And you stayed on that throughout your period in Class W?
And then I remained put in, is what we call pony driving, until 1918, when I was called up. You wanted to talk about when I was called up now?
Not just yet, no. Just a couple more questions about when you were putting. One thing we didn't discuss before the war was, did you have to look after your own pony? How was the pony cared for?
Yes, well... I don't know if I've spoken about what we call the kivels. That is, that every quarter, the end of every quarter of the year, names were put in the hat, and it was the kivelling day in which we were allotted our place of work in one of the seven pits of Ashenden Colliery. And while I was putting, you were allotted to a certain pony, and you had that same pony for the whole of the 3 months while you're putting the tubs into that area, so that you got very well attached to your pony, and your pony got very much attached to you. And it was usual that at bait time, which was halfway through the shift, when we stopped to drink our water and eat our sandwich, which we called bait, the liquid we had was just water, and carried that in a tin water bottle. And we would stay on the landing for 10 minutes or so while we had our water and sandwiches, which we called bait. And invariably, the pony would be at your elbow to collect any little scraps that you had to give him. And as I recall bait time, every driver, every putter, always took extra scraps from home for his pony. So for 3 months you got quite attached to your pony. When you went down the pit at the beginning of the shift, you first of all went to your stables, and the pony was standing in the stables, and you had to put the gear, what we called it, the equipment, the harness, on the pony. And then you led the pony out, and you had to walk the 2 miles, or mile and a half, to the working place. The stables, of course, were at the bottom of the shaft, or within reach of the staff. And invariably, the stables were on the the outgoing side for the air. Ventilation, of course, in the colliery. Fresh air would go down one shaft with the pump drawing the air down. And then the air would go around the workings, and the bad air would be on the outtake side, and there would be a pump at the bottom of another shaft which pumped the bad air out of the pit. The stables always were on the side of the bad air, so that there was no smell from the stables could go into the workings.
Did the ponies ever go out of the mines?
Yes. When I say yes, as you know, miners have always been ready to fight for their rights. Some people call them strikes. A miner's out on strike again. Me, in the whole of my 33 years working down the pit, I was in 5 different strikes. That is when the union called all the workmen of that particular pit out on strike. I remember the first strike I was ever in. I was only a 16-year-old, and I just was finishing pony driving to begin pony putting. And on the way to work one morning, half asleep, I suppose, a group of young fellas, putters, said, "Are you a putter?" I says, "Yes, starting this week." He says, "You're on strike. Go home." And I just turned around and went back home. Didn't know what the strike for, nothing. Actually, that strike only lasted the 1 week. That was the very first week I had on strike. And what it was about, I have no idea.
So you just did what your union told you? You were very loyal to it?
Actually, it wasn't the union that called that strike. It was just a batch of putter lads like myself, but I was only at the beginning of the putting. I was only 16-year-old, and these putters were 17, 18, 19, 20, big fellas, and when they said, "Go back home," there was no denying them. I just turned around and went back home. And I never inquired. Mother never knew, I remember. Mother never knew I'd come back home till I came downstairs in the morning. She said, "I thought you were at work." I said, "Oh, we're on strike." She said, "What for?" I said, "I don't know. I was just sent back." That was the very first strike I was ever in. Another strike I was in lasted 5 weeks, and it was in the coal fields up and down the country. They have the mines rescue teams, and in Ashington we had a mine rescue brigade team with a big hall where they had the fire engines and the rescue apparatus in case of anything happening down the pit. And they had some quarrel, the men who worked on the mines rescue team, with the coal owners, and they decided to come out on strike. And the Ashington miners decided to come out on strike with them. It wasn't our quarrel, it was the quarrel between the mines rescue workers and the coal owners. But Northumberland miners were always sympathetic to anybody who wanted their sympathy, and we came out on strike. We were out 5 weeks.
What year was that, roughly?
Oh, I don't know. But it was
before the war?
Oh, yes, long before the war, yes. And then, of course, we were in I was in the 1926 strike.
That was the third one you were in, was it?
I was in five altogether. But in the 1926 strike, it was a national strike. The whole country came out. And
while we're
on it, we in Northumberland stayed out the whole of those 10 months that strike lasted. It didn't last 10 months for all the whole country, because Nottinghamshire and Somerset and Kent coalfields all went back after the first week. If one knows the history of the 1926 strike, which was a national strike, to the public, it only lasted 1 week. But in Northumberland and Durham, it lasted 10 months. We were out on strike. 10 months with no money coming in. How we existed, I don't know.
While we're on the 26th strike, I'd like to ask some questions about it. How exactly did you manage without money?
Well, the first few weeks you're all right because you have your savings. And in every mining village, of course, the people who lived in those mining villages were very strong on the cooperative movement. And we got big help from the cooperative societies, your own local society, your own town or village, and you sort of ran a certain amount of debt up. At the end of the strike, in that 1926 strike, some families owed hundreds of pounds, and hundreds of pounds was a lot of money in those days. Because before the end of those 10 months, every penny had been spent long, long ago. And there was no guardian's money or things like that unless you signed to pay it all back. And the local board of guardians would supply you with subsistence money. Partly money, partly food vouchers. And all that had to be paid for at the end of the strike. So that at the end of the strike, at 1926 strike, apart from having no money, all families had money to pay back to the guardians. Now, me, I hadn't been married so very long, and I was the scoutmaster of a scout troop. So what we did, with the scout money we had in the funds, and we always were a very financially sound scout troop, early in the summer, there was five scout leaders in my scout troop. They took their wives, we all took our wives, and we camped on the banks of the River Wansbeck. And the owner of the land was a coal owner. And he allowed us to stay after the week's camp. All the scouts with the fathers and the scout leaders who took their wives. The scout camp only lasted for 1 week, but we had a lorry who took us to the camp with all our kit and ourselves. The lorry took the boys back home, and we scout leaders, five scout leaders with our wives, stayed on for many, many weeks afterwards. We were very lucky because the coal owner who owned the land allowed us to go to the cottages on the land, and we bought from the farmers in the neighborhood potatoes which they had for the feeding of their pigs. What happened in those days, the farmers or anyone with a piece of land who kept pigs, they grew potatoes. All the small potatoes were kept for pig food. But we went around and bought those small potatoes, and that was part of our staple food in the remaining weeks of that strike. In addition to that, the gamekeeper had been told by the coal owner who owned the land, don't interfere with the scouts when they go rabbit catching. Now, we knew nothing about rabbit catching, but we were in a country miles from anywhere, and there seemed to be dozens and dozens of rabbits about. So we had great plans to encircle the rabbits and the rabbit holes, and we sort of got stakes and we staked the whole of the area and we juiced the area until we only had the rabbit holes, which were occupied by the rabbits, in the center. And then we had to dig the rabbits out. The landowner allowed us to do this. The ground wasn't too good for agricultural uses. And so we had pig potatoes and rabbits. And that was our main dish. The bit money we had, we bought flour, our wives bought the flour, and made baked bread, and that's how we existed for many, many months. We did. How other people, other miners, they had an awful time of it because they had to exist on the money and the food vouchers from the guardians, which had to be paid back.
So you didn't borrow from the guardians?
No. I had no money to pay back at the end of the strike, 1926 strike. But the 1926 strike, I have very vivid memories of that time because Northumberland and Durham stayed out the whole of the time while the rest of the mining communities up and down the country went back. The national strike, of course, every other workman were back after the first week. Nottinghamshire, here, this county where I'm living now, the miners there were out the first week and then they went back. In fact, they set up a union of their own called Spencer's Union, like they have today when they have this breakaway union.